Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
For word of mouth.
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 From New Hampshire Public Radio, this is Word of Mouth. I'm Virginia Prescott. Stars, they're just like us. The popular feature in Us magazine shows us pictures of celebrities in sweats, going to the supermarket, the park with their kids, how familiar they seem, and how far our notion of fame has come since the days of movie idols like Douglas Fairbanks and Greta Garbo, who might as well have lived on Mount Olympus.
I am my own boss. The fuck that in your pipe and smoke it.
Gods Like Us is a new book by the Boston Globe film critic Ty Burr, which follows our evolving obsession with fame. Burr traces the on-screen and private lives of celebrities from Charlie Chaplin to Julia Roberts to create a cultural biography of modern stardom and fandom, that fine line between audience adoration and resentment. Ty Burr will be reading and signing copies of Gods Like Us for the Cine Salon series at the Howe Library in Hanover, New Hampshire, tonight. Ty, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you, Virginia.
Before there were screens everywhere, there was one that mattered, the silver screen at the cinema. One of its earliest stars was Florence Lawrence. Who was she?
Right. She was the first star that had a name. One of the things I try to explore in the book is how the history of movie stars is a history of secrets gradually being revealed. And the first secret for early movie audiences was the actor's names. There were no names when you went to see a movie. You'd get the title of the film and the company that made it, and that was it. And after about 10 years, the audiences started to go nuts because they had this really intimate, new kind of relationship with these people on the screen who seemed so close, but they didn't know who they were. So they started writing letters to the studios and to the actors begging to know their names. And there are letters that say, please tell me your name. I won't tell anybody. It'll be our secret. And finally, one of the independent studio heads, a guy named Carl Laemmle, who went on to found Universal Pictures, figured it out, and he poached an actress from another company and publicized her by name, Florence Lawrence. And then he did something really unusual. He killed her off. He put out a news report that she'd been run over by a streetcar, and then put out a correction saying, no, she's alive, and by the way, you can come and meet her in person in St. Louis on Sunday. And it was the first movie star mob scene. Thousands of people descended upon this poor actress who had no idea what was going on. And that's really where the starting gun for modern stardom as we know it.
Well, and the other part here is the studio faking her death. Early film studios carefully orchestrating the images of their stars. So Hollywood got it pretty quickly. Could Hollywood just choose to anoint celebrity on anybody?
Well, they could certainly try. And, you know, Carl Laemmle was ahead of the curve. But by the late 20s, by the silent era, and certainly once you get into the 30s and the great movie factories, they were in the unusual position of manufacturing unique personalities on a mass scale. It's very paradoxical. And yes, they would take these young actors and they would mold them and they would make them into what they thought people wanted to see. Clark Gable, for instance, he was a footloose young actor who landed in Hollywood, made 12 movies in 1931 and made everybody sit up and go, who is this hunk? At which point MGM decided they were going to try and tailor his personality, and they would send him out for photo shoots where he's hunting and fishing and doing all these man's man things. And he didn't do those in life, but he picked them up. He started hunting, he started fishing, he started playing polo. He's basically reversed engineered his personality from his persona.
Well, some of the prevailing early gods, the Charlie Chaplins, the Mary Pickfords, the Douglas Fairbanks. You write that it was the stars that gave movies appeal. Fans wanted them to remain kind of unchanged, really, from picture to picture, as you were saying. Now, all this really changed for the early stars with the advent of sound. Here is America's sweetheart, Mary Pickford, in her first talkie, Coquette, from 1929.
My gracious, Stanley. After that, you'd have to forgive me for murder.
Yes, that's the trouble. What do you want me to forgive?
No, say you'll forgive first.
I'll forgive.
Oh, I don't reckon we're so terribly much anyhow. I sort of got things twisted. But I was wondering, did we have a date to go to the dance tonight?
Mary Pickford from the 1929 talkie, Coquette, a nice southern accent there. Ty Burr, you write about this change in technology as a baby step toward giving the audience control of the machine. What do you mean?
What I mean is that the history of movies and the history of fame over the course of 100-plus years of popular culture is really the history of technology gradually bringing the tools of celebrity closer to us, bit by bit. You go from silent films to the talkies, where we can hear what people actually sound like. When TV comes in, we've got a box in our room, you know, in our living room, that brings the stars to us and changes them. All of a sudden, they're not glamorous movie stars, but they're people like you and me, Jackie Gleason, you know, as Ralph Cramden, Lucille Ball as Lucy Ricardo. And then as you move further on into modern times, cable TV and the VHS, the videotape revolution, and then, of course, we eventually get to the Internet, where the means of stardom are at last in the hands of the people, where... You know, my teenage daughter can come home after school, shoot a video, edit it on her laptop, put it out on YouTube, and have it seen in theory by everybody on the planet, which 100 years ago only Mary Pickford and Charlie Chaplin could.
Mm-hmm. So the gods cease to be gods when everybody can play them, I guess.
That's right. What happens to the old school movie stars when that happens? Well, they get mocked in many cases.
Well, this cutting them down to size reveals this dual nature of our love for them that you write about continually, how that shifts in the book. So what's behind that, this kind of, you know, fine line between adoration and envy?
Envy is a very good word. A scene I kind of revisit through the book is the mob scene. It happens to Florence Lawrence. It happens to Shirley Temple. It happens to Clark Gable, where they go out in public and they're besieged by this crowd that literally tears at their clothes and rips their buttons off and grabs at their shoes, and it's almost as if they're trying to devour them. We have a very complicated love-hate relationship with celebrities because we adore them, because we think somehow because they're on TV or in the movies they're better than us, but we also resent them because how dare they elevate themselves to that position? Why aren't they grateful when they misbehave? And also, we want some of that for ourselves.
That's the Boston Globe film critic Ty Burr. He's with us to talk about his new book, Gods Like Us, on movie stardom and modern fame. Well, let's get to some of these kind of seismic shifts in the way that we think about celebrity. Three that you talk about that transformed pop culture in the decade after World War II, the first being Marlon Brando's recalibration of the male performance and Hollywood stardom, then rock and roll, then the unstoppable rise of TV. But I'd like to focus on Brando. Here he is playing Stanley Kowalski in Elia Kazan's 1951 film of the Tennessee Williams play, A Streetcar Named Desire.
Go wash up and then help me clear the table.
Now, that's how I'm going to clear the table. Don't you ever talk that way to me. Pig, Polack, disgusting, vulgar, greasy. Those kind of words have been on your tongue, and your sister's tongue is too much around here. What do you think you are, a pair of queens? I just remember what Huey Long said, that every man's a king, and I'm the king around here. And don't you forget it.
Whoa, we can hear this smoldering hostility. I cannot imagine out of any actors preceding him. What makes him stand out as a celebrity?
He changed film performance, how you were supposed to be on stage and in film, and he also changed people's approaches and attitudes towards stardom. He seemed to be real. And the thing I talk about in the book is we're always, each generation sort of kills off its parents' movie stars in a search for something that's more relevant, more real to them. And Brando in 1949 was about as real as it got. There are stories of him coming on stage in his Broadway days and people thinking a stagehand had wandered on stage. There was nobody doing anything like him, and it was threatening. As a star, he was the first star to say, this is ridiculous. Mm-hmm. Stardom is for kids. It's for babies. It's childish. I want nothing to do with it. And to sort of erect this sense of hostility around the whole notion of stardom, which, of course, made him a bigger star than ever, much to his confusion.
In fact, he told the New York Post, the theater's just a job like slicing bologna, you know, but the pay's better.
And there's a whole male lineage that descends from him, you know, from James Dean to Robert De Niro to Edward Norton to Ryan Gosling, of actors who wear their stardom like a hair shirt and for whom acting is this great macho mystery. And I think with the arrival of Meryl Streep in the 80s, you sort of see the female Brando, not that, you know, and there's no hostility there, and there's none of the sort of agonizing over stardom, but there is a deep, deep immersion in craft and a willing to almost like disappear into a role.
Mm. And Meryl Streep also signaling for you the return to glamour in Hollywood, that the Harrison Fords, the Tom Cruise. Tom Cruise is one of the actors that kind of signaled that departure from the everyman, you know, the Dustin Hoffman or the Steve McQueen, who didn't necessarily have the movie star looks. Here he is, showing a kind of uber masculinity in the 1986 film Top Gun.
The best driver in his reel from each class has his name on it. And they have the option to come back here to be Top Gun instructors. You think your name's going to be on that plaque?
Yes, sir.
That's pretty arrogant, considering the company you're in.
Yes, sir.
I like that in the pilot.
Well, he doesn't say much, but Cruise certainly held his own at the box office in the 80s and 90s. When did he transition from star to object of ridicule?
We've always had a funny dance with Tom Cruise. I think he's actually one of the most fascinating figures in American stardom. In the 80s, he allied himself with Paul Newman in Color of Money, Dustin Hoffman in Rain Man. Then he gave an Oscar-nominated performance in Born on the 4th of July. For a while there, he wanted desperately to be taken seriously as an actor, and nobody took him seriously as an actor. And you know what? His performances in those films are actually very, very good, and I find it hilarious that the year he was actually nominated for Best Actor for Born on the 4th of July, it was the same year that Daniel Day-Lewis was nominated for My Left Foot. So you have these two gorgeous, sexy hunks, both of them trying as hard as they can to portray the greater infirmity, like Tom Cruise. I have no legs, Daniel Day-Lewis. Well, I can only use my toe. And who wins the Oscar? Well, the one with the British accent, of course.
Well, and then, of course, years later, in 2005, Tom Cruise has his famous meltdown on Oprah. We've got just a short edit of it, but we have to remind people of how it came off.
Something happened to you.
I'm in love.
We've never seen you behave this way before.
I know.
Have you ever felt this way before?
That, of course, is the sound of alighting on the couch, arms akimbo, shaking fists up in the air. The audience seemed to relish that downfall. So what is it that crosses too far in a downfall? What goes beyond reinvention?
Well, there's two things going on in that particular clip. First of all, you know, Cruise had recently fired his publicist, his manager.
Right. Replaced it with his sister.
And his manager had been, Pat Kingsley, had been running his career very, very carefully for decades. And so all of a sudden, he was off message. He was off script. He thought he was behaving the way people in love behave. First of all, that's rarely how people in love behave. But that's also not what we really want from Tom Cruise. The second thing that's going on there, before the internet, that clip might have been laughed about on Letterman for a week and then forgotten. But because of YouTube, that clip was repurposed and played with and toyed with and different soundtracks added and special effects added. And it's almost like we were playing with the corpse of his persona like roadkill.
Although they have pretty charmed lives, I think, on some level, it can't be an easy time to be a movie star. There's almost a demand that your life doesn't encounter any great hiccups or flaws.
Well, absolutely. And in fact, the star's real life is often the subsidiary stream of entertainment. I think of Sandra Bullock, who a couple of years ago had a big comeback. I mean, she was relegated to airplane movies. That was the joke about her. You'd see her movies on airplanes. And then she had, a couple of years ago, she had a big hit, The Proposal, and then she was in The Blind Side and won an Oscar, and she completely restarted her career as a movie star and a movie actress. But it didn't really take until a couple of months later when her husband was cheating on her and she landed on the cover of All the Tabs. And that all of a sudden really fired her up into the stratosphere. It's almost like she had to have a real-life scandal to matter in this new playing field that we have.
I'm wondering if, looking at them now and looking through the cultural history that you wrote in this book, do we create celebrities? Do they create us?
It's a very complex process. It's mysterious. It's some sort of pop cultural algorithm that, you know, I try to get to the bottom of in the book, but I really don't come close. Do we create celebrities? Sure. Do we create stars? Yes. We anoint Clark Gable, you know, or Daniel Day-Lewis, you know, by looking at them and saying, wow, I want to see more of that person. They've got something interesting that I want to see more of. Does the star create their persona? Sure, they whether consciously or not, they're projecting something that's a version of themselves. And sometimes it really is conscious. One of my favorite quotes in the book is from John Wayne later in life when he said, "Yeah, when I started out, I knew I wasn't much of an actor, so I went to work on the John Wayne thing. I practiced in front of a mirror," which is the exact opposite of what we think of John Wayne as. We think he was the natural man. We don't even think of him as an actor, but he worked on it. In a way, John Wayne was his greatest performance, was Marion Morrison's greatest performance.
Ty Burr, I want to thank you so much for talking with us today. I really enjoyed it.
Thank you, Virginia. Appreciate it.
Everybody's a dreamer, and everybody's a star, and everybody's in movies. It doesn't matter who you are.
Ty Burr, film critic for the Boston Globe and author of Gods Like Us on Movie Stardom and Modern Fame. You'll find more on the book and his previous book, The Best Old Movies for Families, at wordofmouthradio.org. Ty is appearing in New Hampshire tonight. He'll be reading at the Cine Salon series. That's at the Howe Library in Hanover. That's at 7 this evening. Details on the reading also at wordofmouthradio.org.